This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 235, where today CJ and I are going to catch up on a lot of news from Google Cloud and Microsoft and Office 365, recorded live January 18th, 2018.
While many IT teams struggle with the impact of deploying Office 365, Zscaler customers are experiencing 40% or greater network performance across file download times, as well as TCP and DNS connection times, compared to using next-gen firewalls and UTMs to route Office 365 traffic locally to the internet. While you may know Zscaler as the leader in cloud security, they also have hundreds of customers who are processing over 1.2 petabytes of Office 365 traffic monthly through the Zscaler cloud. Visit www.zscaler.com to learn more.
Good afternoon, CJ, from the frigid Florida.
What is going on down there, man?
Dude, it's cold.
Wild and crazy.
It is 20 degrees colder where I am right now than it is in Seattle. Boom.
Yeah, that's insanity.
We had a wind chill this morning below 20.
What?
Yep. Crazy. I was going to try and go run, and then I was like, nope. Playing a nope card on that one.
Do you guys even have heating in your house? I mean, normally it's pretty warm, right? You've got lots of AC.
No, but... I got lots of AC. No. We definitely have heat. Air conditioning is definitely required, but we have heat. It gets cold like in the 20s, you know, for, I don't know, a week or two. This is our second or third stint that we've had where it's gotten, you know, down in the 20s and 30s like this. But yeah, it took a while just to get above freezing today. So
that's nuts, man.
Yeah. Welcome to the frigid Florida.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. How you been, man?
Very good, actually. Yeah, I've been doing a bunch of coding, actually, and getting on top of some new features and like that. So I'm all jazzed about coding at the moment. I'll just lead with this and say, I now know more about Active Directory schema management and how schemas work in Active Directory than I ever wanted to know. I was hunting this bug that took me all afternoon yesterday. And a lot of head beating and pain and suffering. And it all came down to, because we, you know, part of our product at Hyperfish works against on-premises Active Directory, right? And the connector that we have for Active Directory was playing up in this one particular scenario. And so trying to track down why it was not finding a particular attribute on a user was very interesting.
that can be quite tricky, yeah.
Let's just say Active Directory is kind of like a NoSQL database that was designed in the 50s. I mean, LDAP.
Gotcha. Yeah. LDAP,
as a protocol, was designed quite a long time ago. I don't know if it was 50s, but it was definitely 60s, if not 50s.
Well, that was a Lotus thing, right?
I don't know, actually. I don't know where it originally came from. Possibly an IBM thing. No, yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I have had to dive into some of the LDAP RFC stuff. Mm. But what's really, it's actually quite brilliant in some ways, but infuriating in others. Like, it's a very old technology now, but it's incredibly flexible and powerful as a sort of a structured data store perspective. But when you're used to dealing with modern technology, it is infuriating to deal with.
Got to be a reason why it's been around for so long.
Well, yes, exactly. Needless to say, AD is like a database that supports like completely flexible schema and multiple inheritance. There you go.
Oh, man.
And it's painful. Anywho, fun stuff. Yeah. But yes, I found it last night at 1 a.m. I found it at like 11 p.m., but it took me till 1 a.m. to have the fix all sorted. And so this morning I've been playing around with that and, you know, making sure I haven't inadvertently introduced any other issues.
Yeah. Run all those tests, make sure everything still passes.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. Man. Yes. Yeah. How about yourself? You're in the middle of a pretty big deal this week, right?
I am. Yeah. It's been the last week has been crazy busy. I published two new chapters for the Mastering the SharePoint Framework course. One of them is on provisioning assets, including upgrading them, like SiteComms, content types, et cetera, with SharePoint Framework. And then the other one is around versioning and upgrading both your developer environment and also your code projects. So I shipped both of those this week. or late last week, early this week. And then at the same time, I'm also delivering a live class, which I'm delivering it 2 times a day. So once at 9 a.m. my time and once at 4 p.m. my time. And that's just to get the most coverage across the globe as I could for people who are interested.
Mm.
It's turning into being, you spend about an hour and a half getting everything sorted for the class that day. So really starting around like 7:30. And then so from 7:30 until about, it goes for about 3 hours. So 2 3-hour sessions, that's 6 hours, 4 hours in the middle of the day. There's 10 hours plus an hour and a half at the beginning, 11 and a half hour days. It's a little, and at the same time, my virtual machine that I use to do all this stuff has decided to just start completely crap in the bed.
Yeah.
So, and if that's not enough, I decided to completely rejig my entire network at home over the last week.
Yes. Yeah. You've been changing out all of the systems in the airplane while you're flying it.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. I'm joining the Unify movement. Welcome to the club. Oh man, it's nice. It really is nice. The last pieces of it are showing up today to replace 2 other switches, and I have to extend my network to get to the garage. But yeah, it's cool, man. I didn't realize that Unify stuff. You and I chatted about it the other day.
Mm.
It didn't click for me that Unify is really like your own software defined networking, and so it's all SDN. So I've got. You go in, and when I added in the router, I went to my network and I just said, went to the controller part of my network and said, here's the subnet that I want to use. Here's the IP range. Here's the DHCP range for the server. Here's the DNS that I want to use. Save. And when I plugged the gateway in or the router in, it found it. And
picked up all the changes.
Yeah. Once I adopted it to my network, it's like, okay, we'll just push all these changes to it. Everything rebooted. And within about like 5 minutes, the network was humming along. So it's pretty cool. I love it.
Yeah, that's nice. Well done. You won't go back now. It's hard to get off the stuff.
Well, my old Asus router is on eBay right now. So there you go.
Nice.
Hey, I got one more bit of, I guess, personal-ish news. I guess not personal news, but next week, oh man, I hope I'm not going to be jumping the gun too much on this, but next week or the week that this comes out, Rencor and I have teamed up to do a developer survey for SharePoint developers. So we're doing this in 2 pieces. They're hosting one survey, which is a lot of stuff about like the business side of SharePoint development mm-hmm. and adoption and stuff like that. And so they've got a survey that they're running. We got a bunch of freebies that were given away. There are some there's some cash prizes that we're delivering. There are some, I think, what was it? A couple of cash prizes, a couple Amazon gift cards. I think they're giving away like a registration to 1 or 2 conferences, and I'm giving away a registration to my class. And then in about a couple weeks after their survey concludes, we're both teaming up again for a survey that I'm hosting, which will be more on the nuts and bolts of the developer stuff. So think like that JavaScript survey that came out, the state of JavaScript,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be more like what mine is going to be about. And so we're teaming up to kind of have a good 2 different surveys, 2 different approaches, and they're all free. We're giving away free stuff, but I know we'll take the results from both of them, and you'll see a lot of like blog posts coming out. We're going to do a couple interviews and webinars and stuff to look at it. So it should be, for SharePoint developers, it should be pretty interesting, pretty enlightening in seeing what people are doing these days.
Yeah, for sure. That sounds really, sounds good.
Yep.
I look forward to filling it out.
Yeah. So here we go, man. We got a bunch of news. We got a boatload of news to go through here. So yeah, here we go. So first one, let's start. Kind of jumping around there.
What are we going to begin with? What should we start with?
We should start with a call out to one of our fantastic sponsors.
That's a good call.
Let's hear from one of our sponsors that helps us put on a great show like this.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
All right, and we're back. All right, CJ, this is Andrew. Let's start with some Google Cloud, because we have a lot of Microsoft news, but I got two bits of Google Cloud news here. First one that I've got is a announcement. This is from back in December, but I found this kind of interesting. You know that site called Etsy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's a global marketplace for, they say global marketplace for unique and creative goods. So like handmade jewelry, cards and stuff. It's a really cool, it's kind of like the crafty side of like an Upwork or something. It's a really cool site. Mm. They have decided to select Google Cloud. Ooh, that was almost a big mistake there. They've decided to select Google Cloud as their primary cloud provider. So it's going to power all of Etsy's global services, connecting millions of people around the world to buy and sell beautiful products. And they selected Google Cloud, the Google Cloud platform, GCP, because it brings to the table a shared engineering culture, superior infrastructure, and sophistication in areas such as machine learning and big data.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, Google Cloud, like we've covered them a little bit on the show, and they seem to be winning over quite a few sort of startups. They look very attractive to that sort of consumer startup-y world.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, right?
I suspect they're just doing a great job with containers and Kubernetes, and it all makes sense. So, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
You know, the one thing that I do find, I'm pretty sure this is true, so I don't think I'm disclosing fake news here, but I'm pretty sure that I read, you know, Microsoft, when it comes to Azure, Microsoft is run by Azure. Like all of MSIT is either by now has already been migrated over to Azure or is still in the process of migrating. I know as of last year, they were about over 50% done, but there weren't going to be any more like Microsoft data centers. Everything was going to be inside of Azure data centers and Office. AWS was originally built for Amazon to host Amazon and Amazon services. And then they commercialized it and started selling it to, you know, the likes of us. If I'm not mistaken, the Google Cloud platform doesn't power Google. Like Google has their own internal stuff they use, like Borg and all that stuff to manage all their stuff.
Yeah. But
they don't use, I mean, I'm sure parts of Google use GCP, but my understanding is the core of GCP does not, or the core of Google is not powered by GCP.
Yeah, gotcha. It's kind of the opposite direction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Came first.
Yeah, as I remember seeing an argument, I think it was last year.
I think
year.
You could argue that a lot that it is though, because I think a lot of GCP has come from the way Google run their infrastructure. So, I mean, it's hard to say if that's different enough that you could say it runs on GCP or not. I don't know. I think you're right, though.
Mm. Yeah. The other bit of news from GCP is from early in January, they announced something called preemptible GPUs.
Yeah.
They're doing a discount of preemptible GPUs are 50% off. So what these do is they dramatically change how you think and pay for computational resources for high throughput, batch computing, machine learning, scientific research, et cetera. And so what these things do, this is really interesting how they let you do this. You have the ability to have a VM and then attach GPUs to that VM.
Mm.
And what they do, they say that the you can now attach a NVIDIA K80 and an NVIDIA P100 GPU to preemptible VMs for 22 cents to 73 cents per GPU hour, respectively. And it's 50% cheaper than the GPUs attached to on-demand instances.
Mm.
So it's I'm not entirely sure how the preemptible piece works to it. It seems to me that that's more
They give you 30 seconds warning that your VM is about to go away.
Yeah, yeah. So it's an interesting kind of a model there. It's very different, but
I guess if you're doing a lot of big data crunching, yeah, those sorts of scenarios, you spin up a bunch of machines and you distribute the load across a lot of different machines. You can do it much more cheaply by doing preemptible, so long as you're cool with stopping what you're doing within the 30 seconds, finishing up your job, and then that VM goes away. And you can always go create new ones, you know, to add back into the pool, so to speak. But yeah, this will give you a way to lower your costs in very distributed and data intensive tasks, which is kind of nice. You know, it's like filling up the little gaps in their infrastructure. You know, they're using all the little corners of available compute power. They can offer you that cheaply, so long as you're okay with that compute power going away at a moment's notice. So Yeah, interesting. I've actually been, I think I mentioned it on the show last week, I switched to a burstable virtual machine in Azure for my dev environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm absolutely loving it. I have my Mac, obviously, which I use as my primary machine, but I also have a Windows dev box that I use. And that was running in Parallels on my Mac. And I've switched it all into running in a VM in Azure. And the thing I like about it is I just RDP in from my Mac, and I've got multi-mon RDP, and so it's just like I'm on a big multi-mon Windows box. And periodically, I get a little bit of lag, so it's not perfect, but it's totally usable. But when I go home, I don't even have to get my laptop out of my bag. I just sit at my office desk. I've got a desktop at home, sit down, double-click the RDP connection, and I'm back into my dev box with no setup required. And so my ability to just get up and running is significantly lower. I'm really liking the portability aspect of it. But anyhow, but yeah, I'm using burstable VMs for that. A burstable virtual, two VMs, but yeah, the primary one is a burstable virtual machine. And the performance is great. Like I don't have any slowdowns or anything like that. I guess because it's running a lot of the time, it's just, you know, typing into an IDE is not very CPU intensive. And so you build up a lot of credits. And then you can burst, like when you do a compile or something, or an intensive task, you've got plenty of credits to burst. So it's been working out really well. If you haven't tried burstable VMs for those sorts of things, it seems to work really well for a dev box.
Cool. Very cool.
Yeah, I wanted to try it out, and I was prepared to, you know, switch to a non-burstable instance to get around performance problems if I had any. But so far, I haven't had any, and it's very cost-effective. They're pretty cheap.
Yeah, you sit there and you build up those credits while it's running that you can be, you know, really, I think we talked a little bit about it last week too, or you can get those credits while you're not using it. It's still running, but you build them up so then you can get the performance for it, but only not have to pay nearly as much.
Yeah. Hey, should we move on to some office news?
Yeah, what kind of stuff you got for
us? Well, I think probably the most exciting one is these new site templates and designs. I don't think they're calling them templates, are they?
I think they are.
SharePoint site designs in Office 365.
I think so, yeah.
So you and I saw this at Ignite last year. We saw the early sort of beta of it, or the, you know, they announced that they were doing some of this. But this is a new way to basically templatize creation of SharePoint sites in Office 365 in a repeatable and rubber stamp kind of way. And it's pretty nice. The cool part about it is it's not just, you know, what you define in your template and away you go, but there's a whole process behind the provisioning of the site using that template, and it can make calls out to other things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can call out to, you know, and have a function, an Azure function, do a piece of work against that site as part of the configuration of the site. So if you sort of want to bust out of the declarative parts of your template, you can do that and get into code to go and apply configuration or customization that you want. So they've really thought through some of the more advanced scenarios that people need in site customization and creation. I don't know, when is that rolling out? Do you know if that's rolling out now or if that's...
That's rolling out now. That is available on a lot of sites today. I've got a post not only from the... We got the announcement post in the show notes from Mark Cashman from the SharePoint community blog, but I also have a link to a blog post that Chris O'Brien, SharePoint MVP or Office MVP, that he talked about it as well, and how you can take advantage of either using these site design scripts or by using the PMP templates and talking about the differences between the two and which one makes the most sense. So
they're all quite closely related, right? Because the stuff has come from the folks that look after PMP. So it's it does feel related and pretty similar in some aspects. But they've done a very nice job on it, honestly. I mean, I haven't dived super deep on it, but the examples that we saw at Ignite last year and this whole concept of being able to bust out of the declarative stuff and into code is really nice.
It is. I mean, it's a much preferred approach too, I think, that using a more code approach instead of using this declarative stuff and having more granular control over it. Plus, I mean, when you do stuff programmatically, you can get errors back that you can act on and you can either trap and handle. And it's easier to debug this stuff when you're building these kinds of templated based solutions than the declarative stuff of effectively throwing it over the wall and seeing if your neighbor yells out and says it didn't work. And you're like, ah, crap. Now, so tell me what didn't work. And It's a lot like, you know, like you're trying to throw something over the fence and say, go get this done. So
yeah, it also, I think people will use these hooks for telemetry capture as well.
Yeah.
You know, so you can hook it and capture a whole bunch of interesting information about the site and who's doing what and all that sort of stuff, and capturing telemetry about provisioning and things. Kind of cool.
Absolutely. Another bit of news that we saw that came out was around the general availability of the SharePoint migration tool and the SharePoint migration assessment tool, or at least there's some updates to it. And we heard a little bit about this at the Ignite conference, and there was some discussion about, you know, does this migration start to infringe on what some of Microsoft's vendors do? The idea here is that these tools are to help you migrate from an content from an on-premise SharePoint site or on-premises file shares up to SharePoint or Office 365, sorry, to SharePoint or OneDrive in Office 365. Mm. And they're based on a bunch of the learnings that Microsoft has had from running the Fast Track program.
Yeah.
These tools are going to help you with migration, kind of out-of-the-box stuff. I don't think that... I haven't used either one because, and frankly, I don't really do migrations. But, you know, I don't think it's one of those things that, you know, you look at a company like a ShareGate or an AvePoint or a Metalogix and say, you know, is their business being infringed by this? I think this is great for companies that have data that they need to move, and maybe this would be the first step to kind of evaluate what's going to be done. But for the control and the customizations and the stuff that a real enterprise product does, like those three vendors I just mentioned a second ago, it's not going to compete with something like that. But it still is a great solution and an offering from Microsoft out of the box to help you get to the cloud at a low-cost thing. So
I agree. Gets you off to the races for free for the basics. And I think that'll suit a lot of like small businesses and things like that.
Yeah, agreed.
I definitely don't think it's a replacement for some of those more enterprise-y type requirements.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Hey, I've got an interesting one. So people have been logging in to their Office 365 administrator portal and having a recommendation pop up about password resets. Mm. And in particular, my password reset, my recommendation was kind of interesting. I'm going to read this verbatim from the text that pops up in the notification. Recommended for you. We recommend that you set passwords to never expire to avoid possible disruption. Currently, passwords expire every 730 days.
Okay, so that's what you saw. For my tenant, mine says every 90 days.
Yeah, lots of people have had 90 days that I've seen as well. I think mine expire every 730 because we have MFA turned on by default for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that seems to affect the expiration policies. I don't know if you guys use MFA in your tenant or not, but... yeah, that seems to affect it. And so I did some digging on this. I tweeted about it and I got some interesting replies. One reply in particular was from a Microsoft guy called Jeff Wilcox, who I've dealt with in the past. And he said, I wonder if this is related to the 2017 updates to the NIST password guidelines, which is, I can't remember what NIST stands for. But anyway, so there's a whole bunch of password guidelines. And in those guidelines, 6.3, the guideline 6.3 around expiration, CSPs, which I think stands for content service providers, may issue authenticators that expire. If and when an authenticator expires, it shall not be usable for authentication, right? So that's MFA effectively. Mm-hmm. When an authentication is attempt using an expired authenticator, the CSP should give an indication to the subscriber that the authentication failure is due to expiration rather than some other cause. Then it goes on to say that in the cases where this is the case, you don't need passwords expiring. So basically they're saying if you're using MFA, you don't need to be rolling passwords. Then Microsoft goes even further. And if you dive into the view the recommendation button and they've got a password guidelines PDF, they've done a bunch of research that say that rolling passwords is not effective anymore. And the reason being is statistically, when you make people roll passwords, they start choosing simpler ones because they'll be like, my password one, my password two, my password three, right? Mm. Been there. And if you know what somebody's password is, on average, it only takes 5 guesses to get their next one that they've chosen.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So they're basically saying rolling passwords is no longer effective. And they've got some interesting statistics to back up those findings. That was pretty interesting, I thought. So, of course, I'm not sure I could recommend turning off rolling passwords, But I do recommend using MFA for sure. And I've turned off password expiry in our tenant because now we've got MFA. We don't need it. During all this, Alex Simons, who's he's a director of program management in the Microsoft Identity division, he chimed in to a conversation I was having with David Rosenthal on Twitter when we were talking about, hey, wouldn't it be great if Azure Active Directory supported passwordless authentication like Microsoft Account does? You know, in Microsoft Account, you can set it to not require a password. Mm-hmm. And so it'll just send you a code on your phone and the authenticator app, you just hit approve and you're in. You don't even have to type your Microsoft Account password anymore. Mm-hmm. It certainly sounds like they're bringing that to Azure Active Directory soon. Yep. And the other one is I said, I really love FIDO with Azure Active Directory. And FIDO is, there's an alliance called the FIDO Alliance, which is Fast Identity Online. And it's basically defines a standard for being able to effectively do MFA, but with things like physical tokens and stuff like that. And so if you've ever heard of the YubiKey, mm-hmm. it's a small device that you can plug in to your laptop, which basically provides MFA tokens using, you know, you push a button and it provides a token to your browser. Alex replied, who's the director of PM for the identity division, to my tweet that said, oh, FIDO and AAD would be marvelous. Then he replied, soon, so soon.
Ooh.
And that's like, excellent.
That's pretty cool.
So I use a YubiKey for authenticating to things like GitHub, Slack, I think. Yeah, a couple of others. Quite a few sites support it now. I can't remember. I've just totally blanked which ones I use it for now. Oh, Facebook, I think, supports it as well. There's a bunch. I use a YubiKey for that. So when I'm on a new device that I've never authenticated with that service before, it'll prompt me to put my YubiKey in and hit the button. And so it's really, really easy. And it makes MFA ultra simple, like without having to mess around with apps on your phone and type in codes and things that don't work and all that sort of stuff. Anywho, it works really well. So I am stoked to hearing that that's coming to Azure Active Directory soon. And it'll mean that we'll be able to issue like YubiKeys and things like that for really straightforward, simple MFA into Office 365, into the Azure portal, into anything that authenticates with Azure Active Directory identities.
That's really cool. It would be nice if, I wish that right now only, which is funny that Microsoft is the one that does this because it seems to me that they're usually a little bit behind where the rest of the industry is going on this, but it would be nice if, like, say LastPass, and they have their LastPass authenticator or the Google authenticator, mm-hmm. that their MFA apps that get those keys, it'd be nice if those were extended to, like, say, the Apple Watch. The Microsoft Authenticator app, when I get an authentication prompt, I don't have to pull my phone out. I get a little buzz on my phone, which is the alert from the that I get on my phone. Mm. And I get a little alert on my watch and I can just say, tap, authenticate. And it's so simple. I wish I had the same thing for LastPass as well. But
wouldn't it be nice if you just, when you went to Office 365 and you had to log in, all you did was just put your username and hit go. And then your watch buzzed and you pushed the button and that was no password and multi-factor auth in play. That's awesome.
What would be really nice, and I know you can do this, but what would be really nice if that same thing was set up and I can use multiple accounts registered with my Authenticator app to do that, which I know you can. But like, I know I use like probably 7 or 8 different AAD apps or AAD tenants and authentication in Azure.
So super painful.
Yeah, so it'd be like, and I mean, if it wasn't for LastPass, I'd be...
Yeah, I use password same way. That's, yeah, cool. Necessary. So yeah, password policy changes and passwordless auth and FIDO coming to Azure Active Directory.
Very cool.
Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focused on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out for free. for 30 days at www.nintex.com/trynwc.
I have another Office 365 bit of news here to share with us. There was a recent release back in the middle of January of the Office 365 CLI. This is an effort that I'm going to put Waldeck MasterCards as the real guy behind this. It's a little unfortunate. I think that it's a little unfortunate that the messaging for this really, it all comes out from the Office dev blog, because when it first came out, I know a few people that reached out to me, they were like, oh man, this thing kind of stinks because it only has like four or five commands in it that I can do, when the PowerShell stuff can do so much more. And once I explained them, like, you do realize that this is not Microsoft that's building this. This is a PNP effort, or more specifically, it's an effort by the community that then got added to PNP. Mm-hmm. Waldeck is a big driver behind it, but there's a handful of other people who've contributed to it. I contributed the site collection app catalog commands, but I think it would help to know that it's much more community-based. Well, recently they added support for the Office 365 CLI for in version 4 for working with custom actions. My two commands got in there for adding and removing site collection app catalogs, working with modern team sites and communication sites so I can get a list of all of my modern sites, which I can't see unless I have the new SharePoint admin portal preview, which you can only get if you opted into it around Ignite, and they've shut that down. So now you can't even get into the preview and see your stuff. That's a weird story there. But there was all that. And then they also added support for scripts using the Office 365 CLI so that you could have like a command run. You could write like a bash script and have all your commands kind of run to do like, say, provision your site or something. It's pretty cool. There is one thing that's in here. They also had command completion. So like autocomplete or has been added to it as well. So we're doing a really good job with this. It's nice because, hey, we don't need PowerShell to go do a bunch of our stuff. But
yeah, it'd be nice to see it more broad than just SharePoint.
It's going to. So the idea is that it's actually written to be much more open. Sure. The only thing that's kind of screwy about it, it works. It's a little irritating because I think Microsoft the Office team wasn't very forward thinking about this. They built all the stuff that you do with the PowerShell command prompt in the Office 360 or the SharePoint management shell. Mm-hmm. It uses the CSOM endpoint to send all of its requests over.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so when we've wanted to implement some things, like when I wanted to implement the stuff for the site collection app catalog, I had to do it with the PowerShell command. I had to look at the source or use a fiddler to watch the traffic go back and forth and then reverse engineer what the actual request was. I had to submit to it.
Yeah.
And I just did a copy of the big XML blob that I was sending over to it and then figured out how to parse it. And so
I'm pretty sure the CSOM endpoint is documented in Microsoft protocol documents.
Well, so it is, but it's basically like a big WCF. A big WCF service. So you're still sending a bunch of XML over and getting JSON as a response. It's just kind of nasty, but I mean, it works. It works. I mean, it's cool. It's good, cool updates to it. There is one bit of this though, that it's kind of tipping their hand to it. So I can talk about this because it's part of the release layout or the release notes. So how about I just quote from this and not go too deep, and I'll give you my 2 cents. So it says, when working with the CLI, we're trying to balance individual, including functionality that you can use already today with functionality that you'll be able to use very soon. In the latest version of the Office 365 CLI, we added a few commands related to service principal and permission requests, as well as managing the Azure AD directory. More information about these commands is coming soon once the related Office 365 capabilities have been made publicly available. Now, let me pivot and let me just talk a little bit about what they talked about at the over in the JavaScript and SharePoint Framework PNP special interest group. And we're going to be getting the ability through the graph to grant permissions to apps via a tenant permission so that from the SharePoint Framework, you'll be able to call authenticated APIs via the graph and Microsoft will be doing it on your behalf. The same way we did with add-ins and having those remote
proxy
proxy URLs. So that's pretty cool, being able to have a secure way to finally call or a way to call secured APIs without doing an additional authentication hop on the client and forcing you through that.
Super nice. I'm really glad that they're looking at that because it's ultra painful as a third party with a third party API somewhere else on the internet that you want to call and authenticate with it and all that sort of stuff. Hard work. So yeah, nice. That's really good. Cool. I got an interesting one real quickly. There's a report that I found on the, I don't know if you use the Windows subsystem for Linux at all, you know, WSL. Mm-hmm. If you're a Windows 10 user and you're a developer, you should definitely install this and try it out. But it basically gives you like an Ubuntu subsystem or SUSE Linux subsystem running on Windows 10. And you can use all of the tools for that world as well as your Windows world. But anyway, this person came out with a report that did a bunch of testing on WSL, and there's just, we'll link to it in the show notes. I won't get into it in all lots of details, but in short, it's great computationally. It's pretty painful on IO. That's kind of a summary. But there's lots of charts and lots of tests they ran. It's impressive how fast it is with from a computation side. And it keeps up with bare metal Linux in on the computation side, but not on the IO side. And I know that Windows and Microsoft have done a lot of, been doing a lot of work on the IO performance. And so we should expect a bunch of improvements there. But anyway, I just thought it was a really interesting report.
Oh, I had not seen this yet.
Yeah, yeah. I've got another one, which is called Amazon Lost Cloud Market Share to Microsoft in the fourth quarter.
Ooh.
Yeah, so this is really curious. It came out on the 12th of January. It's an article by a guy called Jordan Novert. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Anyway, he basically gets into saying that the market share slipped from 68% a year earlier to 62% this quarter. And that Microsoft are taking that share, basically. Google is taking some share as well, but Microsoft is taking the majority of that change, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. He also mentions or has sort of reverse engineered the numbers and say that Azure is likely contributing about $3.7 billion to Microsoft's 2017 revenue now, which I say reverse engineering because Microsoft doesn't just outright say that number, and you've got to kind of read the tea leaves and reverse engineer the numbers and try to put two and two together. But they say that Azure's revenue growth grew 88% in fiscal year 2018. AWS grew about 42% in the third quarter. Yeah, some other interesting numbers in there that you should go check out.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. That's interesting that it's hard to see, like, you know, how do you measure market share for a cloud product? I mean, I get it with, like, say, phones, or I get it with, you know, PCs and laptops and stuff. But with cloud share being so easy for, you know, someone to go spin up a new instance over in AWS, or to, you know, migrate their stuff from Azure over to AWS, you know, how do you measure that? How do you actually detect that from third party without the actual vendors sharing that information?
And go do customer surveys and figure out how much they're spending anonymously on each cloud service and try to derive from there, I guess. But yeah, it'd be pretty tough.
It's the best you can do. It's the best you can do. Hey, I want to go back to one point here. I just skipped over here about that Office 365 CLI.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a tweet that actually came out today. So we're recording this on Thursday, January 18th. There was a tweet from someone on the PMP group that asked about, you know, hey, are you interested? What do you think about? Or sorry, it was quoted as, would you be interested in running PMP PowerShell on Mac or Linux, even if it would initially come without support of the PMP provisioning engine? So basically all the PMP PowerShell scripts, would you be interested in having those as being cross-platform? Because today they're just Windows PowerShell. They're not like the cross-platform PowerShell.
Mm.
And my take on that, I responded right back. I was like, no, I'd rather people be investing in the CLI because, I mean, I get that some people love PowerShell, but that's not the way that the industry goes. The industry goes CLI, and the industry is more on having CLIs that are more cross-platform than having going with a PowerShell instance these days. And it's interesting to watch the responses that have been coming back on Twitter to this poll that's out there.
I can see the benefits of PowerShell versus a CLI for automation and of things and provisioning. Because if you're using a CLI, then you're having to use like flaky bash scripts and stuff like that to automate it. If you're trying to use it for automated scripting in a repeatable process, whereas PowerShell is kind of much more powerful for that kind of stuff. So I could see the benefit of it, but yeah, it's like they're going to try and do both, and what, and neither will be perfect. I'd rather see them invest in one versus both.
Yeah, I would too. I would
just
too.
For resources spread thin, all that sort of stuff.
Well, and again, this is PMP doing it in two separate groups of PMP, so it's definitely not a Microsoft thing, but.
Yeah, gotcha.
So, hey, that's a lot of news we got covered throughout the day. Want to get onto the fun part of the show?
Yeah, let's do it.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right, CJ, I have a trio of picks. So I'm going to let you, I'll let you start and go through one of your picks first, and I'll throw out one of mine, but I'm going to let you have the floor first, sir.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, I've got two picks. One's really simple. It's an animated GIF, which compares the size of the Saturn V to the Falcon Heavy that is about to go. And it's pretty interesting. Like, Saturn V was a really, really, really big rocket. And Falcon 9 is getting up there. It's like, if it's not three quarters the size, it's got to be pretty close. Mm. If you take the tower off the top of the Saturn V, at least anyway. So the image, the animated GIF is really worth checking out. I think they've sort of put the Saturn V into some of the drone footage that Elon Musk tweeted the other day about the Falcon Heavy on the pad at Kennedy. So pretty nice job of that. The other one that I've got is an article, or a video, I should say, called Casting a $20 Million Mirror for the World's Largest Telescope. And it's a video about the process of building and creating the largest mirror ever made.
Wow.
And it is mind-blowing how cool this is, how they cast a mirror that size and polish it and how long it takes and how they get it within, you know, 20 nanometers of perfection. And, polishing takes like 18 months.
To begin, more than 17,000 kilograms of special glass are ordered and inspected for flaws. Wow.
It is amazing.
That's pretty cool.
And apparently this place that builds these is under like Arizona University's football field or something like that.
Huh.
Yeah. Like the mirror lab is below the football field or something. I heard something like that.
Wow.
Kind of curious.
That's cool. Yeah, it's called the Giant Magellan Telescope, the GMT.
Yeah. And you'll see when this thing's built, the building, it's pretty impressive. I just had no idea how you go about building something like this. And so the video was fascinating.
That's really cool.
Yeah. What do you got for us?
I'm going to go on with the, continue with our space picks. There was a article, I've been holding onto this for a while. This one came out towards the end of December. NASA hopes to send a probe to Alpha Centauri in 2069. So Alpha Centauri is like the nearest star to us. And the idea is that, it's even though this is 52 years away, it's timed quite coincidentally in the 100th anniversary of Apollo 11's trip to the moon. The idea is to really just to explore what we can set out and see how far we can get. And Alpha Centauri is about 4.4 light years away. So a spaceship or a vehicle traveling at a tenth of the speed of light is going to take 44 years to arrive. So that means that it's going to take us a long time to send this thing to get it out there. But I have an article about it, talking about this thing they're sending. And there's another article that this one links to that I was reading. And one of the problems is not so much sending the spacecraft there, but it's being able to communicate with it and having enough power to still manage the vehicle as it's going to Alpha Centauri and being able to get the data back from it. And you're starting to run into totally different problems and just signals degrading over that much time and stuff. So
that's really cool.
Yeah.
on a repeat.
That's one of them. Another one, I have a fun one, and then I have another interesting one. So I have a fun one where the other day, I'm sitting there minding my own business and not doing anything. And on January the 16th, I get a little alert on my phone saying that someone mentioned me on Twitter, which, you know, okay, you see those every once in a while. But the person that mentioned me is rarely mentions me, or I rarely see my name mentioned with him. Mm-hmm. Guy named Scott Allen. And Scott Allen is one of the things he's known for is being one of the highest revenue generators from Pluralsight. He was their first $1 million a year author from royalties. So he did this blog post. The tweet is called The Cloud is a Small World. And he did this blog post where he looked at his blog and found the public IP to his blog on Azure, on his Azure app service, and then did a reverse lookup and said, well, I wonder, because Azure shares IPs, I wonder who else shares the same IP. And so he went back and he looked at it, and you get a lot of results coming back. But then he started to go through it and started to look at all the names and was like going, I wonder if I know any of these people. And sure enough, apparently Scott Allen, Rachel Apple, myself, Alan Ashcroft, and a couple other people share the same IP. And his post was, the tweets started to get a little funny about this, but one of his things was, what if I could wander around my stamp, his IP, like a character in a Gibson novel? Who would I see? Who do I share an IP address? Do I share an IP address with a celebrity website? Do I live in a criminalized neighborhood where bewildered Netsians show up being clickjacked? Or do I have any neighbors who would lend me 2 eggs and a cup of all-purpose flour in a pinch? And so my response to him was, this is too cool. And Scott, no worries, dude. I got 2 eggs, a cup of flour, a teaspoon of sugar, and a beer. All I ask is you put a parcel on my take the parcel off my front porch so someone doesn't swipe it.
Funny. Yeah.
So it's pretty cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I just looked up mine, and I got to figure out like where I see. I have 73 websites attached. I can't tell if you're on it. I've got a page through it, but anywho.
Yeah, I was curious because I was like, I wonder, as he said, I wonder how Azure allocates these. Is it that, you know, we all kind of created our sites at the same time or whatever? And so it got in a fun little tweet going back and forth. I'm looking to re-platform my my blog and my site at some point during 2018. And I was just like, well, I'm just going to, you know, throw away the old app service and stand up a new one with a new site. And so I think one of my tweets that went back to him, I was like, and here's the thing, I was going to stand up a new instance and redeploy planned later this year instead of buying a new plot. I think I'll just bulldoze and rebuild on the same plot with neighbors like these.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So it's just what a fun exercise.
It's completely unnecessary, but thought it was fun.
Yeah.
The last pick that I have, this one was really cool. So you know how with like, say, Google Analytics or other things, you can do a lot, and App Insights, you can track users' behavior and activity on your site?
Yeah.
And you know how like Safari, Apple Safari, and a couple other things, they have these do not track, and they have ways of going through and disabling JavaScript so that you can't make these kind of calls?
Yeah.
So this dude that I've linked to on GitHub, he has a project called Crooked Style Sheets, and he shows a pattern of how he's just doing tracking of people using CSS, only CSS.
It's random.
It's really cool.
Impressive. Wow. Okay.
So you can do browser detection. The general idea is in CSS, you can add an image from an external resource using like a URL and then putting the URL.
Yeah.
This resource is only loaded when it's needed. So when like a link is clicked, so you can't disable it otherwise. So if you want to like say create a selector in CSS so that when someone clicks a specific link, you could do, now I'm going to read out the code here, but do hash symbol link to, which is going to give you like the ID, colon active, colon, colon after. So after you click the specific link, the content of that CSS selector is URL, and then the path is track.php, and then a query string value, action equals link to clicked. Isn't that cool?
That's pretty interesting. It's funny how people find this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
Nice picks.
Yeah, I had a hell of a lot more, man. This was hard to kind of whittle it down. So I guess future episodes.
Put it in the backlog.
Oh, it is. It is.
Nice.
Awesome, man. Hey, it was good fun today.
Yeah, definitely. Great to catch up, even midweek while you're dealing with a course. So much appreciated that. Hope it all goes well.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing about it at the end of the week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, I'm having a good time with it, but I'm looking forward to being over so I can kind of get back to my normal routine.
Oh yeah, I bet.
So, cool, man.
All right, have a good one.
You do the same, bud.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a wave or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter, at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.